This program deals with themes of an adult nature and is intended for a mature audience.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings.
Our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world.
We must guard against the military-industrial complex.
Exopolitics, paranormal phenomena, and deep analysis of current world events from somewhere in the desert between Area 51 and Roswell, blasting across the planet, the Manticore Network proudly presents Fairy Tales, because the truth will set you free.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Forces has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
The power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty!
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Sooner or later, though, you always have to wake up.
Be skeptical, but don't close your mind.
Greetings to everyone around the world, and a warm welcome to another edition of Veritas, where we uncover the truth, one guest at a time. For those who dare to seek, Veritas is the place where they shall find. I'm your host, Mel Fabregas, and I sincerely thank you for joining me once again. And if this is your first time, make yourself at home. I want to thank all our members. As always, you are keeping Veritas alive. Tonight's special guest is one of the best UFO illustrators of modern times and a great UFO researcher. He is back, Jim Nichols. UFO history, the Archons, the Gnostics, and how it all fits together. Jim will be with us shortly. To listen to the complete version of this and all our past and future shows, become a member. You will receive immediate access to all our inventory of shows, the Veritas private chat room, and the Manticore Forum. You'll head on over to our website, veritasshow.com, click on subscribe, and take Veritas with you. And have you looked at our newest, hottest product? Yes, it is still hot because it is still selling. It's the 8GB brushed metal case USB drive containing all of Season 1 and a lot of bonus material. It's now in stock. You may want to check out what else is included. There's a lot of material crammed into this futuristic piece of Veritas history. And some people have emails saying that they simply travel with the USB drive, they plug it into their computer, turn on iTunes, and listen to all the shows without having to wait for any downloads. And in addition, get a lot of bonus material. So again, go to the website, veritasshow.com, and click on the Veritas store and find out. And if you need to get in touch with me, go to our website and click on the contact button or on Facebook. And now, get ready to find out what we have been told is mythology and science fiction, when in fact, it could very well be true history, removed from our consciousness as a way to limit our potential. If you want to know about the Archons, the Gnostics, the Nazis, the Vatican, and more, don't go anywhere. This is Mel Fabregas, and you are listening to Veritas. Music you hear right here on the Veritas Show is supplied by the independent artists from Jamendo.com. If you hear a song you like, go over to our homepage, VeritasShow.com, click on the guest, look up the song, and download it. You can even buy the group's CDs, in many cases right there at Jamendo.com.
This is Jay Widener, and you're listening to Veritas.
Jim Nichols was born a post-war baby boomer in 1948 in the flatlands of northwestern Ohio. By the time he had reached his senior year of high school, Jim's restless creativity fueled in him an abiding ambition to become an artist. Even while serving 2 years of Army service, he managed to complete a correspondence course in commercial art. Following his discharge, Jim resettled in Tucson, Arizona in 1972. For a time, cactus, sagebrush, mountains, and skies dominated his artistry, and he made something of a name for himself as a painter of southwestern landscapes. By the late 1970s, however, he discovered he could not be content to limit his art to just desert scenes. Popular films of the day like Star Wars and Close Encounters rekindled a love of science fiction that he knew as a youngster. Soon, alien landscapes and spaceships captivated his creativity. Beginning in 1980 and throughout the following decades, Jim painted numerous UFO illustrations that have been published internationally. His notoriety in the field of UFO research earned him a co-host seat on a weekly public access television program in Tucson, produced by Ted Lohman, entitled UFO AZ Talks. This popular award-winning program ran from 1991 through 1997 and was aired on public access channels across the country. Currently, after so many years of painting, fine art, and illustration, Jim has expanded his creative talents to include sculpting as well, thus bringing an added dimension to his legacy of artistic skill. And as you already know from his first appearance on the show last year, Jim is also a well-known and respected UFO researcher. And directly from the beautiful desert of Tucson, Arizona, I would like to welcome Jim Nichols. Hello, Jim, and welcome back to Veritas. How are you?
Well, it's always good to talk with you. We always have fun things to discuss, don't we?
We always do. Whenever we meet, you know, Jim and I have met a few times at different places. And honestly, I always admired that combination of artist and researcher. And to those of you who haven't heard of Jim before, if you haven't listened to the other show we did before, if you saw some of Jim's art, you'll know exactly the art I'm talking about. I mean, whenever I see your art, Jim, it takes me back, although I was not born in the 50s, I was born in the 60s. Whenever I see movies from that time, it reminds me of the art that you produce.
Very good.
Is that something you've been told?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I don't see how you can escape and not make the connection, because my art is so is so influenced by Hollywood, and that, you know, Hollywood movies were really what inspired my interest in UFOs and flying saucers and so forth back in that era. And you know, come to find out, it was no accident that we were seeing films like that. That was part of a collusion between Hollywood and Washington to educate the public about the possibility of life off this earth. And so, and it's like I'm just a product of that program.
You mentioned something very interesting, the connection between Hollywood and Washington. And there are times, there are decades in which we see very movies that put extraterrestrials in a good light. I remember the 80s, you had E.T. and The Last Starfighter and so on. And then all of a sudden it changes, and sometimes they portray it as negative. Why the contrast, Jim?
That's a very good question. Are they good guys or are they bad guys? And I think if you If you look at Hollywood films, actually, it's like prior to 1947, there were hardly any science fiction films at all. And then, bingo, we had the crash at Roswell, right? And then in the early 50s, we had lots of films like War of the Worlds and Earth versus the Flying Saucers and 20 Million Miles to Earth, where you saw marauding aliens, you know, attacking. And it's like that terrified, audiences, and it made beings from outer space look absolutely terrifying, horrifying. And then we kind of got away from that. And I'm not sure, there seems to be some waffling in policies coming from Washington about just how do we approach this, and do we use this as a tool? Do we use the scare tactics of hostile extraterrestrials to our advantage to make our own to make our own governmental power greater, to increase our own military power as the military-industrial complex would have it. If we have a huge military budget, can we afford to let our guard down and assume that extraterrestrials are all going to be benevolent?
And that's a question in everybody's mind. You know, if we all envisioned a peaceful world where every country can get along, and many people talk about a new world order. And as I've said on many occasions, I don't see a one world government, because that if the military industrial complex that Eisenhower referred to really exists, and it does, and it continues to expand its tentacles of one hydra, if you will, we will always have a separation of different regions, just like Orwell said in 1984. So in the back of our minds, when we see all these movies, do you think there's an agenda out there to prepare us to the culmination of, and I sound like a broken record, folks, but I have to, the report from Iron Mountain that says that the in order to unite the world, we need an alien invasion. Is this a propaganda machine in full force to put this thought in our mind?
Well, I can't say definitively one way or the other, but it would certainly be a useful tool, don't you think? I mean, you look at, Orson Welles proved that back in 1938 when he did his War of the Worlds radio program. It's like this,
right?
Whether he did or did not have a government collusion with that as a propaganda piece, it's like you can't tell me that people within the Defense Department or within the CIA, the intelligence community, would not look at something like that and say, wow, that could be a very useful tool for creating a scenario where we could take advantage of that militarily.
And in the past few weeks, as you know, we've had a few guests who devote a lot of the research into the Nazi UFO connection. Jay Whitener, Joseph Farrell, Jim Mars, who else? Peter Lavenda, you. It seems that whenever I think I've concluded, I bring somebody else to continue that. Why is there so much connection and so much research taking place after, you know, almost 60 years after World War II that tells me that this Nazism, if you will, continues?
Wow, that's the I have the same question. For crying out loud, I was born a baby boy. I was born right after World War II, and all I knew was the euphoria, and it's like the United States is whoopee, the most powerful nation in the world, and look how we whooped the Nazis and all that stuff. And then here, 60 years later, there's all this undercurrent that did we really defeat the Nazis? And when you go back and look at the technologies that they were developing at the time, hell, they had television. They had smart bombs. The smart bombs were used in the Iraq War and in the Kuwait, the Gulf War. The Germans had developed those bombs all the way back for World War II. Television-guided bombs. They had developed remote-controlled flying bombs. that we called, ballistic missiles. Even the father of quantum physics, Max Planck, was one of those brilliant, brilliant German physicists. And it's like, how far advanced were the Germans that the rank and file of the American public has absolutely no clue about? And it's like, who really won the war?
And the question in everybody's mind, once again, with all that technology, and I did not know that they had and those types of missiles you're referring to, so that's news to me. But if they had all this technology, if there was somebody being a puppeteer at the time who was allowing Hitler to proceed as fast as he was, and he had all this technology of even, the Nazi bell and so on, how did it change so that they lost the war? Because if they had used all this technology, there's no doubt in my mind that they would have won decisively.
Well, the question is how far up into the German high command was the influence of this technology? It's like, as I understand it, Hitler did order that a certain group within the SS work on free energy projects, which ultimately included the Bell and the flying discs. But I don't think like the main players, like the Luftwaffe, like Göring and the Luftwaffe, I don't know that they genuinely perceived these exotic technologies as I don't know that they saw the incredible potential of these technologies. And so ultimately you had Hitler bogged down in a very conventional war in Europe, while a part of the Reich was struggling to develop these exotic technologies. And it's like, I don't know. Of course, you have funding competition within the Reich. You have the Luftwaffe, and you have corporations that are building the bombers and so forth, all fighting for a chunk of the funding to develop these individual weapons. So I don't know. I question as to how deeply into mainstream Third Reich these technologies actually got. I think it was maybe late in the war that they suddenly realized just how important these technologies were, and that there were other people like Hans Kammler who was sharp enough to capitalize on using those technologies as leverage to make deals with the Allies at the very end of the war.
And you mentioned two words, free energy. I know that at one point Hitler felt threatened because of the Allies were threatening to cut the oil from entering Germany, so that that was what was keeping the Nazi machine going, right?
Both Germany and Japan had
right.
The British and the Americans had a knife at the throat of both the Germans and Japan by cutting off the petroleum. The mm-hmm. Brits and the Americans had absolute monopoly on the petroleum. So, and that was one of the main issues that precipitated the war.
Pearl Harbor.
Hello?
Yeah, but I'm saying that it also precipitated Pearl Harbor because we were blocking the petroleum from entering Japan.
Right. And here was Japan, a newly risen industrial power who suddenly would say, well, you can't be an industrial power anymore because we're not going to let you have petroleum. So it's like,
right.
Oh, well, excuse me, I think we need to work something out here, right? And that's so a lot of the mythology going into the German saucer technology was the impetus behind that was to find some kind of free energy technology that was totally independent of the petroleum cartels.
And how successful did they become in their pursuit of free energy?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Did a portion of the Reich actually just go off and drop off the grid and establish a secret colony in the Antarctic? Or did they develop technologies that were so advanced that they became that they could travel in space? Have they gone off and colonized other worlds that we don't even know about? I mean, it's like the conjecture on that one is very open-ended.
And I'm going to just mention something that some people may think that it's just this pure bunk. But the fact that many believe that Hitler committed suicide in 1945 in his bunker, and now, according to some of the researchers, even my conversations with Peter Lavenda, after the Berlin Wall fell, we started investigating it, and we found that the skull was actually of a woman. And if you look at the show I did with Joseph Farrell, and you look at the pictures that I included there, one was of the alleged body of Hitler, does not look like him. It may very well have been a woman, since Hitler was not that tall, and Germans are usually taller. Perhaps they found a woman, they put a mustache, they shot her in the head, and planted there, took a picture, and nobody actually saw the body. It was the Germans who told the world that, yes, he had committed suicide, right?
Well, was it the Germans, or was it actually the Allies that said he committed suicide? It's so confused because, and it's so fragmented because that part of Berlin, as I understand it, was overrun by the Russians first. And ultimately, it doesn't really matter. Does it really matter? It's like Hitler was like, by the end of the war, if you really look at who was controlling things within the Third Reich, Hitler was kind of an afterthought. I think there were other people who had more power, who had more cunning, that were probably engineering other agendas at that particular point in time, but have been lost either by accident or design to history as we understand it.
But don't you think, Jim, that if other high-ranking members of the Nazi party and the Nazi machine were able to escape, whether via boat or U-boats, don't you think that the leader of the movement would have also, with all that protection around him, would have also escaped, and they could have used a ruse?
Absolutely. The idea that they could have snuck him out of Germany is quite believable. They almost snuck Mussolini out of Italy, and at the last moment that he was captured. But it's quite possible that they were more successful getting Hitler out of Germany. But like I say, it's like, what did that really accomplish? That he, had he really lived and then tried to set up another regime someplace else, maybe a more of an interesting concept. But I think what's more interesting to me is the technologies that survived the end of the Third Reich rather than Hitler himself.
Well, with paperclip, don't you think a lot of this technology made it all the way here? And if that's the case, did the same thing happen in the former Soviet Union with their version of paperclip?
I'm sure it did, because the Soviets were sweeping into areas of Eastern Europe and Czechoslovakia and up there around the Baltic and so forth that were highly, highly classified areas for secret super weapon research. And as I understand it, both the Brits and the Americans and the Russians were all racing at the end of the war to get those technologies. I mean, Patton General Patton was ready to just march right into Berlin, and at the last minute he was diverted to capture Peenemünde. So it's like the technologies, it's like you can see that the technologies became much more a high priority than Hitler himself.
In the research you've done, and I've discussed this with many, many of the former guests on Veritas, where do you think this technology, where did it come from? Was it and you have to say, whatever Hitler did, we will never forget, but you have to admire the technology that they came up with. Where do you think this brain tank got their information from?
Well, that's a good question. And of course, the conjecture, and thanks to Hermann Oberth and some of his comments, was that they were being assisted by extraterrestrials. Without hard proof one way or the other, that's just fascinating conjecture. But you have to look at what they achieved, their technologies that they achieved. You have to say, well, maybe. And even Wernher von Braun, later on, he went to work for NASA, of course, and said the same thing. And it's like, which makes you question, well, who's really in charge here? Who's really running the show here? The media and everything, it's like they tell us what they want us to know. But what is the real truth here? Who's really in charge in this planet?
But as you always say, and I use this quote all the time, when you go to Area 51 and you see the gate, you wonder what reality is, this side of the fence where we are or on the other side. So it makes you wonder.
Let me recommend a really good piece of research for you. And Wendell Stevens has an ebook about Nazi UFOs. And within that, there's extremely interesting passage or chapter about that specifically deals with this issue of the German connection with extraterrestrials. And it said that they did, in fact, made contact with a civilization that exists on a planet that orbits the Aldebaran star. And Aldebaran being the eye of the bull, it's the eye of Taurus. Constellation Taurus is Aldebaran, and that they did in fact make connection with a civilization there. And this civilization shared technologies with the certain societies within the Third Reich, which would be the Vril Society specifically, and with the intent of using these technologies to create free energy production here on this planet, which would enable better exchange between nations, which would improve economics here, and would actually, in fact, reduce the war issues that are chronic on this planet. But once again, it's like those technologies were used for other reasons other than the intent that the Aldebaran shared them. And the question is at some point, did the Aldebarans withdraw these technologies from planet Earth, seeing that they were being misused?
What is the name of the ebook, and how can people get to it?
That's a tough question. It's an ebook, and specific name of it eludes me at the moment, but it's something about Nazi flying discs, I think. In fact, I think that is the name, Nazi flying discs.
And I respect Colonel Wendell Stevens, but how did he, where's the proof to substantiate these claims, which sound like science fiction, but, you know, I respect him.
He had some contacts that I can't recall at the moment that supplied some of this information to him. But of course, he'd been researching this for a long, long time, and I'm sure he had multiple sources for this information. But it's a good clearinghouse where it brings all these concepts together, and you get a clearer picture of what, in fact, may have been going on behind the scenes within the Reich that was allowing these technologies to flourish.
And I keep finding fascinating the fact that the Nazis went to Tibet and the Tibetan monks went to Germany and so on. There was an exchange there, and Hitler thought that the origins of the Aryan race came from there, and that leads to the inner Earth and the hollow Earth. Tell me more about that.
Oh, absolutely. Well, what they discovered was that the civilization from Aldebaran was very similar to what we would understand as the ancient Sumerians, and that the Sumerian language was phonetically very similar to spoken German. So there seemed to be a kinship. The Germans who were studying this, they seemed to sense a kinship between the Aldebarans and the Germans or the ancient, the Aryans, this concept of the Aryans. And maybe, in fact, that the Sumeria was a colony from Aldebaran. And that's part of the conjecture of this whole myth.
Is there a relation between Aldebaran and Nibiru, the Anunnaki?
I can't say that. I can't. There would almost have to be, since the Anunnaki were so involved with Sumeria.
Exactly. That's why I asked.
Established civilization of Sumeria. And actually, Anunnaki, all Anunnaki means is that they came from the stars.
Right.
They came from the sky.
From the stars from above.
Right. So if they were coming from Aldebaran, they would still be Anunnaki because they came from the sky.
And for those listening, well, when the show airs, probably these would have happened already. But when we're recording this show, I have information that on August 27th, Mars, and this is just a quick factoid, will look almost like a second moon here in the Western Hemisphere. And we don't see that in, I believe it's every 227 years. So if you didn't see it, you're not going to see it again. So almost like a second moon.
Second moon. Well, watch for those cylinders landing. People War of the Worlds all over again.
Have you seen the previews to the movie Iron Sky?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that? Is there some reality behind what they're trying to portray?
Well, is there reality behind Men in Black? The movie Men in Black. It's like, it's a fascinating concept. I'm a little dismayed that they've made a comedy out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it'd be fun to see, fun to watch and say, well, do the Germans, are they telling us something serious with tongue-in-cheek? Did the Germans establish a base on the moon?
And for those who are listening, in case you wonder what I'm talking about, there's a, I believe it's a Finnish movie from Finland, and it talks about, as Jim is saying, that the Germans, when the war ended, World War II, they left. And they left to Antarctica, and from Antarctica they went to the moon, and now they're getting ready to come back. So whether it is true or not, we don't know. But again, we have series like Stargate, we have Star Trek and so on, that although it is science fiction, they mix a lot of what could be reality. But in case anybody says, well, this is reality, somebody else will say, no, it's just Hollywood and science fiction. So it's the perfect way for Hollywood to hide the concepts and the technology, don't you think?
Yeah, to hide it right out in plain sight, right, Mel?
Exactly.
Exactly. Well, you know, if the Germans had actually built, like, the Honeyboo 3 and the Honeyboo 4, one was a 200-foot diameter craft, the other was like a 600-foot diameter craft that, according to the plans, the designs, these are ships that were specifically built for interstellar space travel. So it's like, if these craft are actually built, there's probably no limit to where they could have gone.
And I cannot help but always wonder, the word NASA, we know it's an acronym, but it sounds so similar to Nazi, and there were so many Nazis also involved with it. So I wonder if it's tongue in cheek that they, you know, created that name. But I'm out of curiosity. You're in Tucson, March of 1997, the Phoenix Lights. What's your take on that? Do you think that was a UFO? I mean, an extraterrestrial craft? Or you think potentially it could have been one of ours? Speaking of what we're talking about, the Nazi technology and so on.
Well, if it's not one of ours, which it well could be, if you really do your homework and do your research about what kind of anti-gravity engines the Germans were allegedly working on at the end of 1945, had they actually built those engines, anti-gravity engines, they could be applied to virtually any kind of airform. So they could apply those engines to a circular craft, or they could apply those engines to a flying wing. So if they did in fact create that, it is well within the realm of possibility that a craft the size and the design of whatever flew over Phoenix in 97 could in fact be a product of planet Earth technology. Or it could be an extraterrestrial. But if it was an invader, if it was an invader from outer space, why didn't our Air Force go up and
chase him?
Chase it.
Yes.
Why didn't they go
right
up and confront them? Why did the fighters at Luke Air Force Base stand down? I thought that was their job, to protect a city the size of Phoenix. Why is nobody up there protecting it?
And we have plenty of Air Force bases here in Arizona.
Right.
And we can't forget Ben Rich's words. If you can imagine it, we've produced it. And in order for us to get this information out, it's going to have to be an act of God. But yes, you know Angela Joyner. You know, we talk about the Stephenville lights all the time. And back then, you saw those lights, and all of a sudden, you see the Air Force moving in so quickly, F-15s all the time. But here we are, an event that was watched by thousands of people in Phoenix and Tucson. And I haven't heard once the sound of an aircraft following it.
Well, the other thing is, like, in that slow sashay over Phoenix, imagine how many weapons of mass destruction it could have released.
It's like, exactly.
And nobody's questioning this. So it tells me that somebody either knows ahead of time that there's some kind of collusion here, that the ET or the extraterrestrial thing is like, well, I mean, what's the whole point of having a defense department if they're not the least bit interested about defending us? So it's like the logic tells you, no, there's other agendas going on here that we're just simply not privy to.
And of course, that's if we believe that there were flares, there was no need to send the Air Force. Or, you know, you think of the Pentagon, which is the most protected building in the entire world, and then all of a sudden you get an alleged plane crashing into it on September the 11th. Come on, folks. As Jim Marsh would say, come on, folks, wake up. But there's a reason why I brought you in today, Jim, aside from being a great researcher. You've been contacting me for the past few months to talk about one thing, and I want to really understand what this is, and that's the word archons.
Archons.
And I know Jay Whitener, archons.
And archons.
Archons.
Not icons. Archons.
No, archons. Archons.
Yes.
A-R-C-H-O-N. And Jay Whitener talks about this, you talk about it, and I want people to understand, what is an archon?
What is an archon? Wow. Good thing we have a lot of time. forget about archon. Sounds like a strange word. Archon means like magistrate. It's a Greek word that means magistrate. And archon, in the context of our interest in UFOs and so forth, suggests that someone or something from outside our world is a magistrate that controls the human affairs of this planet without their knowing it. And this is a concept that, you know, I didn't set out with doing my UFO paintings to look at, to find out about archons. This is just a bit of research that I've stumbled onto over the last 16 years. And it's a concept that suggests, and I first encountered this when I read a book called Bringers of the Dawn by Barbara Marciniak, okay? And this book was a compilation of channelings that she claimed to have gotten from the Pleiades. And in this channeling, she made reference to the fact that Earth humans are secretly controlled and influenced by a group she referred to as the Lizzies, or as the Reptilians, right? And that somehow this is an extraterrestrial group that has a clandestine interest in the human species of this planet, and somehow they manipulate our lives behind the scenes, beneath our awareness. And that was the first time I'd ever heard this concept. And I thought, well, that's that's kind of far out. And she didn't go into great depth and detail about who they are, where they're from, what they're all about. Just the fact, just to give you the general idea that humans are not so much in control of their affairs here as we'd like to think we are, or as we've been led to believe that we are. So I thought, well, that's interesting. I don't quite know what to make of that belief system or that concept, but I will file that away. It was just like the German saucer thing when I first heard about that. I thought, well, that's that's interesting. It's far out, but I'm just going to file that away and see, you know, let time take its course and see where this idea goes from there. So then a few years later, I came across the research of David Icke.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know David Icke. And David Icke has done parallel research, which seems to independently verify all the things that Barbara Marciniak's Pleiadians were talking about, that, yes, in fact, there is a reptilian group that influences subliminally affairs, human affairs on planet Earth. And he has gone into great, great depth of research in tracing this concept all the way back into ancient history. Okay? So I said, well, that's interesting, and it certainly gives credence to the assertions that were in Barbara Marciniak's book. Well, then a few years passed, and then I came across another book, and this is probably the most powerful book, called Not in His Image, by John Lamb Lash. And this goes into historical texts that were dug up in Nag Hammadi, Egypt, back in 1945, which are Gnostic in origin, which is to say that they're somewhat religious, or there's comparably Christian writings, but writings that have escaped censorship or revision by the Church of Rome. And that these writings are 2,000 years old, that they're probably contemporary with the time of Jesus, with the time of Christ. So to find unedited gospels and unedited texts from that time period is very, very significant. Okay, now within these texts, once they start to study them, they discover, aside from other things that are more, you know, traditionally Christian in origin, they found reference to beings that were referred to by the Gnostics 2,000 years ago. There's reference to these entities, non-physical entities, that surreptitiously influence humans on planet Earth, and they called them archons. They referred to them as archons. Now, what did the archons look like according to the Gnostic texts? And this is where it starts to directly relate to our interest in contemporary ufology and UFO research. The Gnostics claimed, according to John Lash, that these archons were A, reptilian, and B, were small humanoid creatures that looked like oversized human fetuses. Now, excuse me, but doesn't that sound like the Greys?
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So here we have historical reference going back 2,000 years that the humans of planet Earth have been influenced and perhaps controlled without their knowledge by reptilians and by Greys. So that struck me as an absolute blockbuster. And John Lash said the same thing. He says, this is something that, and biblical scholars and religious scholars who study the Gnostic text read this stuff, and they say, this sounds like science fiction, so they just throw it out. John Lash says, wait a minute. This is important stuff. It relates directly to what people within the UFO research field are finding out. And it's like, this stuff needs to be looked at seriously. So that's what led to my, that really sparked my interest being a UFO researcher, that this information has been known to certain people on this planet for at least 2,000 years.
So the origin of the concept of the Archons comes from, or the discovery, rather, comes from the when the clay jars were found in Egypt, the Nag Hammadi?
Apparently, yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And just a quick parenthesis, it just reminds me of Zachariah Sitchin, when we talked about how when you go and see an audience and you talk about how the clay tablets showed, the Sumerian tablets show all this knowledge. And people say, well, but that's so archaic, that's so old. You know, how can those people be so backwards, if you will? But then if we have a cataclysm now, whether a really large coronal mass ejection, a Carrington event, or something along those lines, what will happen with all our data? Where's our data stored these days? Hard drives, all the Veritas show that you old folks have, it's gone. How do we revive the society once again if our knowledge will disappear?
Where's my 8-track tapes?
That's right. Well, they're now on CDs,
right,
fortunately.
Right. It's like, that's very interesting. Apparently, now, if you have to read John Lash's book, it's a 400-page book, and it's probably one of the most valuable books to UFO research that you could find, but it is not a UFO research book in and of itself. It's a book that studies the concept of Gnostic beliefs and their understanding of what the Earth is, that the Earth is, they revere the Earth as a living goddess, as a living entity. And it really shows a body of belief that flourished in the Middle East and in Southern Europe 2,000 years ago, and has been deliberately and systematically suppressed in all those years since then. I think it's very interesting that here we are virtually at the cusp of the new millennium, and this information is resurfacing after 2,000 years.
And there are 13 codices containing over 50 texts. That's a lot of information. How were we able to translate that information into what we are talking about here tonight?
Well, you know, there are really serious biblical scholars who have been studying the Gnostic text, as well as like the Dead Sea Scrolls, and this is an area that John Lash has found very, very interesting. And but like I say, he said that the scholars that study this stuff come across these references to the Archons, the Greys, or the fetuses and the reptilians, and it's like they don't know what to do with this stuff. They don't know where to put it, and so they just dismiss it. And but the implication is that these entities have a deep vested interest in controlling and manipulating human society, and have done so throughout the history of humanity on this planet.
Why is it that the Archons or the reptilians, and by the way, are we referring to the same type? When we talk about reptilians, are we referring to the Archons?
Let's not be too broad here. There is a reptilian species and a gray species that are directly involved with interest in the human race. Now, I will not make a blanket statement and say all the grays and all the reptilians are Archons. That is not my point. But there are two distinct species that are referred to in the Gnostic text that do have a vested, malevolent interest in the humans of this planet.
And even if we categorize them separately, in your opinion, why do they remain in the dark? Where are they? Are they really underground? Are they on the moon?
This is where very confusing. It's because they essentially exist in a dimension slightly off from. They are not three-dimensional entities, and they function more as they interfere with us more psychically, more spiritually, than actually physically. As I understand it, the little grays can move in and out of this dimension much more easier than the reptilians do. And that the grays actually, in this case, the grays referred to in this Gnostic text actually work as in more of as assistance to the reptilian archons. It's the reptilian ones that are really the bosses behind the scene.
Is there a relation between the Nag Hammadi texts and the Gnostics? And were was the Nag Hammadi ever stored in the Library of Alexandria? And for some reason, somebody took these texts and buried them for the future generations to find?
John Lash's book starts out with the attack on the library at Alexandria. Apparently, that library was a huge repository of Gnostic texts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very graphic description of how the lady, this brilliant woman who was the head librarian of the Library of Alexandria, was physically attacked and literally torn limb from limb. And the library was burned. And it's like the people who realized what was going on very desperately hid these, and these are just fragments of a much larger text that was destroyed at the Library of Alexandria. And there's like, you see this concerted effort all over the planet, and it was like the indigenous peoples, it wasn't just the Gnostics, the indigenous peoples all over the world also had access to this information, also realized what was going on. So you see this systematic extermination of indigenous peoples all over the world. It's like wherever there was a potential threat to the takeover, so to speak, of the archons and their thought, anybody who was resisting that was exterminated, eliminated.
Is that why, and this is not an attack on religion, but is this why a lot of the knowledge that we deem as mythology is mythology for a reason? And maybe like Drs. J.J. and Desiree Hertak say, maybe we need to start demythologizing history.
Exactly.
Because the mythology could actually be history.
It's labeled mythology to discredit it.
Right.
Right.
It's like science fiction.
Like science fiction. And we, in modern science and modern, scholars always tend to put down, and they always patronize these ancient teachings and so forth. Like, well, this is just the imaginings of foolish children. We can't really take this seriously. And John Lash would say, wait a minute, I think it's time we start to re-examine some of these ancient teachings and say, wait a minute, what is really going on here? And who is really in charge? I mean, you look at the planet now, it's like, according to Darwinian thought, humans are supposed to be becoming more intelligent. But evolution it seems to be going the opposite direction. Humans are becoming less intelligent. I mean, you can look back, the Sumerians knew that we were the third planet from the sun. And they knew that Earth orbited the sun. And then thousands of years later, you have a pope saying, no, the Earth is flat, it's at the center of the universe, and anybody who disagrees with that will die in the Inquisition. So are we getting, it's like, that doesn't that doesn't sound like we're actually getting smarter at all.
Well, was that how can I put it into words? There was obviously what they deem as a gap of knowledge. You know, as you say, even the Mayans had their observatories before the conquerors, took place, the discovery of America. But all of a sudden, we have this gap of knowledge of this void. But is it really a void? Or was there somebody behind the scenes saying, no, we need to stop this knowledge from the past and, you know, start making people believe in a new reality? And I've also read that the Archons were experts in duplicating reality. Have you heard that too? Explain that.
Well, let me give you an example. If you remember what Stalin did after he took over control of the Soviet Union, he wanted to create a population that was totally obedient and to the party line.
Right.
So what did he do? He rounded up anybody who questioned his authority, sent them off to the gulags in Siberia, and they were never heard from again. So who do you have left? Who do you have left? You have a group of people that all they know is the party line. And then after a while, then the party line is totally unquestioned. It
right.
just is what it is. And I think this is a technique that I think if you look over history, you have seen this is done time after time after time. We have a particular belief system, and we want this to be the only belief system, and so we will eliminate anybody who challenges that belief system.
Competition.
Right. So then you have a whole population that grows and grows, generation after generation, who has absolutely no concept of any other way of thinking. Right?
Right.
Is this an accident, or is this something that's being deliberately engineered? So that, and is this a technique that was in fact originally used by the Archons when they decided they wanted to take over here?
Well, another example, in talking with Peter Lavenda, who you may know, he used to be an executive for this major transnational firm, and he brought some Chinese executives to the United States a few years ago. It took him to New York to a few of the churches, and took him to the cathedral. And a few of the executives came to him after going inside the church, the cathedral, and said, you know, what is this building? What is it? They have never seen a church in their life, because in China, there's no religion, but if there's one, it's the government, the establishment. So that just tells you that once you are towing the party line for so long, as you said, the boundaries are invisible around you.
It's like you can... I would say the Archons are absolute masters of social engineering. And that's how they... That's, if you really... yeah, you have to get into the research and see what it is, how they work, and how their agenda is. I mean, you've read Protocols of the Wise Men of Zion, right?
I've heard part of it, yeah.
Read all of it. Read all of it, and then think of that as, well, who's behind this? What is the mentality behind, what are the entities behind this that have written this blueprint that is all about engineering the social order here?
Well, it makes you wonder. We're in the 21st century. All of a sudden, we are told that we need to go from analog to digital, and they're providing the boxes subsidized to the point that they're free to everybody. You know, I have a hard time believing that our government will give us something for free unless there's a reason that may advance an agenda. And if what you're saying here is true, and the Archons or whoever's behind the scenes, the puppeteer, is advancing an agenda, what a perfect way to use mind control, by using digital signals, the TV. What do you think about that?
Well, you get into the Rise of the Archons, that terrific article that interview with Jeff Rentz and Jay Widener.
Right.
That's a must read, because it goes into great detail on how this agenda works. And it's like, it's like you can't see the forest for the trees. It's all right there in your face, and you don't realize you're being influenced by computers, by internet, by television, by music, there's no aspect of our culture that is immune to this. And actually, the film The Matrix is a brilliant example of how the Archons can create this reality. And in fact, I use the analogy constantly between the Matrix and John Lash's book about the Archons. It's like the Matrix is telling you how the reality that we think we experience every day has been completely engineered by something that's outside our range of perception.
But how are they, before I talk about how they are duplicating reality, we know that we live in a world where peer pressure wins. You know, if you start talking about UFOs, and I was just talking to James Fox yesterday, you know, he's doing a terrific job doing all these oil spill updates. But, you know, if you start talking to somebody and they say, so what do you do? What have you done? And he says, yes, I'm the producer and the filmmaker for Out of the Blue, and I know what I saw. And they say, what is that? Well, it's a UFO documentary. Immediately, they're labeled, we are all labeled as lunatics,
right.
People wearing tinfoil hats, when in reality, this is just a program that the powers that be have there so that we don't even consider it. In other words, put us in the science fiction fringe department, if you will. So peer pressure is very important. But how are they duplicating reality? Is it by using consciousness? How is it?
Well, that's their number one, they're absolute masters of affecting our perception of reality. And they may be able to do it in ways that I can't even conceive of. But, I mean, what is reality? You look around at your room and it's like, well, there's the walls, there's the television, there's my bookcase. It's like, are these things really real? Are any of these real? Or are these projections that I'm just seeing energy forms that my brain reassembles in the back of my brain as physical three-dimensional objects, when in fact none of it actually exists. So are we in somebody's hip pocket and lost in a dream that we think is absolutely real? That I can't answer. That's where it gets so deep into quantum metaphysics that it's very hard to describe and very hard to conceptualize. But yeah, it's like if I was a fifth dimensional being, and I see you as a third dimensional being, and you have no perception that I'm there, and I can say, and I can pop an idea into your head, and you think that's your idea,
right?
And
exactly.
Maybe I can make you do this and that. Maybe I get my jollies in making you do really, really evil, wicked things, and you have no idea that something outside of you is creating that.
Thoughts, dreams, etc. But Jim, we have to take a quick intermission. Once again, how do people get in touch with your great work?
Oh, go to my website www.jimnicholsufoart.com.
When we come back, we're going to be talking about the Archons and much more, and why is it that the Archons are using imitation via TV. Very important. This is Mel Fabregas, and you're listening to Veritas. Don't go anywhere. Thank you very much for listening. We're going to talk more with our special guest in our members section. Head on over to our website, veritasshow.com, click on subscribe, and join us in the members area to tune in to the second part of this great show. We'll take a short break, listen to some music, and we'll be right back with more.
This is Michael Schreck, and you're listening to Veritas.